We can't stop talking about World War II, and that's small wonder since it was a gigantic war that did much to shape the world we live in today. There are parts of World War II that certainly make people uncomfortable in this country. Top of that list would be the placing of Japanese Americans in internment camps, concentration camps if you prefer. The topic gets a new look in a big book by Richard Reeves. The book is called Infamy, The Shocking Story of the Japanese American Internment in World War II. Richard Reeves is an award-winning journalist with many titles and duties to his credit. They include the previous book, President Kennedy, Profile of Power, a large body of work for the New York Times and the New Yorker, and Richard served as chief correspondent for Frontline on PBS. He's currently the senior lecturer at the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California, USC. Richard Reeves, very glad to have you here on the Jefferson Exchange.
Glad to be here.
So we understand your frequent visits to California played a part in this book being born. Tell us about that.
Well, the part that that had to do with was, like many people in Southern California, I would drive up, family would drive up 395 to Mammoth for skiing, and about halfway there, kind of in the middle of nowhere, you pass the gatehouse and the sign for what was Manzanar, which was the largest of the 10 relocation centers, as they were called, or concentration camps, as Franklin Delano Roosevelt called them after he ordered them. And somebody in the car would say, isn't that where they kept the Japanese? Yes, it was. They kept 18,000 of them there. They kept 120,000 of them in camps with machine guns pointed in, tanks, and across the West and two in Arkansas. And for most of them, they were there through the duration of the war, beginning in February of 1942.
There's a real does not compute that comes with learning more about the camps, particularly when you hear that FDR did call them concentration camps, because this is a time when we were fighting for freedom for people around the world, including people who'd been put into concentration camps by Nazi Germany.
Yes. Yes, that was happening. But what the difference is we're Americans, and what I tried to write was an American story from the people on both sides of the barbed wire. After all, none of these people were ever charged with a crime. Their lives were destroyed. They lost their property, their homes. Often the family structure was broken by living in what were designed as prisoner of war camps. So that it was our... One of the things I came across in my own research is that in both Germany and Japan, the Axis forces were using the camps as a propaganda device. They knew more about what was going on than the American people did.
As you dug into the material, and I don't know how much of it was recently declassified or anything along those lines, I mean, were there lots of new surprises for you as you dug into this?
The new surprises were the people who made this happen. Beginning with Roosevelt and Earl Warren, Edward R. Murrow, Walter Lippmann. There was a press frenzy. December 7th, 1941, 3,000 Japanese Americans in Washington, Oregon, and California were picked up by the FBI, and they were taken to federal prisons. Often their families did not know. 13 of them were women, by the way. Most of them, their families took months or sometimes more than a year to find out where their father or mother was being held. But then for a couple of weeks, newspapers were preaching tolerance and they love to use the phrase American sportsmanship. But then the tide turned, and in large measure, it was because of hysterical and inaccurate reporting by the Los Angeles Times and the Hearst newspapers, with stories like little brown men being trained to rape white women, or the fact that Japanese farmers in California, and they produced 40% of California's agricultural product, were planting tomatoes and things in ways that pointed to military installations and factories, so that when the Japanese came over by air, which they didn't have the capability to do, they would be guided to their targets by this saboteur activity in the country. It was all made up. It was all made up. It never happened, and there was never a Japanese-American incident of sabotage in the war.
So I have to believe that the media of that time were not terribly different from the media of this time, and that if one organization had the story, the rest would certainly be looking to see if they could get it into their own publications and radio stations.
That part of it's true, yeah. They were different people, though. In a, you know, prejudice was much more open. After all, Japanese Americans could not become citizens of the United States after the Oriental Exclusion Act of 1924, so that their children could become citizens if they were born here. But the kind of hysteria, racial, it was racism, it was fear. There was a real fear, after all, that the Japanese were going to attack us on the mainland, and greed. I mean, the Japanese owned valuable properties, Japanese Americans, valuable properties, thousands of acres of farmland that they had really made bloom in the desert, and white people wanted them. And the guy who put together the plan to transfer it to the whites was Earl Warren.
That's an amazing thing, yeah.
Attorney General of California at that time.
And well known, of course, as the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court when it rendered the Brown versus Board of Education decision, about 13 years after this. We'll come back and talk more with Richard Reeves about infamy, the shocking story of the Japanese-American internment in World War II, and take your phone calls and emails as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the well-known journalist Richard Reeves, the author of a new book about the internment of Japanese Americans in World War II called simply Infamy, with some new information about what happened at the internment camps as Japanese Americans are rounded up and put into camps. We'll get the number in just a moment and some percentages as well. You can join our discussion on the Jefferson Exchange with Richard, 800-838-3760 around the region, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Richard, I have talked to some people over the years who insisted that the people put in the camps were largely Japanese nationals, but you've got some figures here that indicate that was far from the case.
No, that's not true, yeah. No, in fact, the word that we use widely today, internment, is inaccurate. Internment is a legal term for the interning of enemy aliens during wartime. So that the older Japanese, the Issei, who were not allowed to have citizenship, get in the United States were picked up first, but two-thirds of the people in the camps, the children of these folks, were American citizens. And in a way, it's not a Japanese story, it's an American story on both sides of the barbed wire. What we did and why we did it, what they did and our fellow citizens did, and why they did what they did.
And so when we talk about, we use these terms, Issei, Nisei, and Nikkei. So Issei are the ones who moved here. Nisei are the ones who were born here?
Yes. In second generation, it means.
Mm-hmm.
And there were Sansei, many of whom are alive, the third generation. There were also Kibei. Kibei were American citizens born in the U.S. whose parents sent them to Japan to be educated, and then they came back to the United States and usually took up the family business, growing flowers, growing agricultural products. Ironically and totally secretly, 6,000 Japanese Americans fought in the Pacific War, though the Americans never knew this. And most of them, many of them, were Kibei because they were the only ones who knew enough Japanese to take, to do translation, interrogation, which was more important, and cave flushing, the most dangerous thing in the war, because the Japanese, Imperial Japanese, would not surrender, and they would hide in caves in Iwo Jima, in Okinawa. And these young Japanese Americans, the Kibei, went into those caves and islands and talked the Japanese into surrendering without weapons. The Japanese, Imperial Japanese, were armed. The American kids of Japanese ancestry who went in there were not. And after the war, there were just 6,000 of them. Unit was totally secret. And after the war, General MacArthur's intelligence officer, General Willoughby, said he thought that those 6,000 MIS, Military Intelligence Service, men had shortened the war by 2 years and a million lives.
And it makes you wonder if we'd allowed more Japanese Americans who did want to enlist to be able to do so, what might have happened?
Well, the ones who did enlist, I mean, the way publicly fought in Europe, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team and the 100th Battalion, which was part of that team, landed in Italy in 1944 and became the most decorated military unit in American history. They were incredible fighters, but they still were treated as if they were different from us. There were stories of their bravery, incredible stories, front page of the New York Times, when they rescued a lost battalion called the Texas Battalion in Italy, a battalion surrounded by German troops. And they fought their way through the Germans and brought out the Texas guys. New York Times ran that as a front page story. It was a morale builder. However, they never mentioned that these people were Japanese American. And in the story, they simply called them doughboys as soldiers. The Japanese American from the camps and from Hawaii were the first troops to reach both Rome, the first Axis capital that we captured, and Dachau, the first concentration camp that we liberated. But when they got to Rome, they were ordered to stay in place for 2 days so that enough white troops could be brought up to triumphantly enter Rome as the victors, while the Japanese were trucked back into the Japanese Americans, including Senator, then Lieutenant Dan Inouye, were taken in trucks and moved away from the city.
Oh, so they had.
So
to have
we really were conflicted about how to deal with all this.
Okay, you mentioned, Richard, that Japanese Americans began getting arrested right after Pearl Harbor. Nobody was charged
right.
with crimes, you said, but which raises a question that you do address in the book about what happened to German Americans and Italian Americans, other people who represented Axis countries we were then about to get into a fight with.
Well, they were enemy aliens, exactly the same, but. The rule was one drop of Japanese blood. They scoured orphanages to find orphans. They went to families who had adopted Japanese children and took those children away because they had one drop of Japanese blood. If we did the same thing with Germans and Italians, we would have had to have concentration camps for 50 million people. That's how many, at that time, that's how many of us had some German blood or Italian blood in us, so that it was. And the same thing was true in Hawaii, where 47% of the population was Japanese American. But if they were all picked up, then the economy of Hawaii would have collapsed. So in the end, It was more politics than national security. Roosevelt directed it, and then people below him carried it out, and they pretty much sealed off all information until after the 1944 elections, when Roosevelt was afraid that if he lost the West Coast to Thomas E. Dewey, he would lose the presidency.
There are some people in here, names that that come up in the book, of people who did at least try to get the word across that this was not a good way to go. Lieutenant Commander Kenneth Ringel comes up in the book. What was he famous for?
Ringel was a lieutenant commander who was fluent in Navy, fluent in Japanese. He had worked for 6 years at the American consulate there. He and to a lesser degree, the FBI gathered the intelligence that went to the president's desk. And that intelligence, in Ringel's judgment, was that the domestic Japanese were not a problem. The Ringel, with government permission, recruited safecrackers from San Quentin Prison, who were then used to break into Japanese consulates around the country. It didn't start with Watergate, to find out what the Japanese were saying. And what they found in the papers that they then were transmitted to the president was that the Japanese were reporting back to Tokyo, there's no point in trying to recruit spies or anyone else from the Japanese-American community. They're fiercely patriotic. We could never trust any of them. Why don't we see what we can do with Negroes and communists?
All right, we're talking to Richard Reeves.
And that was Ken Ringel's work that did that. It then passed through several hands. Roosevelt actually had his own private intelligence service of private citizens who reported to him, and they were the ones who brought Ringel's information to the president.
And even then, he didn't change his choice of ways in which to move forward.
There were internal voices, not many external, not many people talked about it openly, who said this is insanity, which it turned out to be. But Roosevelt was a great man. He was fighting a war. He was running a country, and in the crunch, when the Attorney General, Nicholas Biddle, said he wanted to talk to him about the constitutionality of this, Roosevelt said he didn't have time and he didn't want to hear about this again. A week after he was reelected in 1944, he gave us fireside chat saying what an outrage it was that they were keeping Japanese in these camps.
Really? Huh. Wow. You would have thought a little better of FDR, but we have more to learn about what happened with Japanese-American internments during World War II. Richard Reeves wrote the book Infamy. He's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for waiting to Don and Eugene. Welcome to the Exchange.
Hi. I have to disagree with you about one thing. I do agree in general that it was a hysterical reaction, which I think we can somewhat forgive ourselves for. But there was an incident called the Nihao incident. Are you familiar with that?
I'm not familiar with that name. I probably know the incident.
Okay. Well, there was a pilot from the Imperial Japanese Fleet.
In Hawaii.
Yes. And, he was a pilot who attacked
Pearl
Harbor.
That.
And he crashed on the island of Niihau. And if you look up a man named Harada, who was a Japanese-American living on the island, and he and two other Japanese Americans caused injury and harm to the people living on the Americans living on Niihau.
Mm-hmm.
They took the side of the Japanese pilot, and that is
there was never an attack. I mean, the Japanese pilot had them at gunpoint, and no Americans were injured before he was captured.
All right. Thanks for bringing that up, Don. Appreciate that. Mark and Redding, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Richard Reeves. Whoops, I just lost Mark and Redding. There's Mark and Redding. There he goes.
I am. Am I here?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, this is, of course, only the, I guess, most recent of our infamies to non-white people in this country. One prior to that, to the Japanese internment, was the deportation of Mexicans that started during the Hoover administration and didn't end until the war started and we needed braceros. But we also deported the children of Mexicans who happened to be U.S. citizens, just like the Japanese were, many of whom didn't speak any Spanish, but we deported them to Mexico anyway. At any rate, I knew a man when I was a child who had been interned and was in the Pacific Theater. Whether he was involved in cave diving or not, I don't know. But he told me that after the war was over, he was in Okinawa, and they wanted him to go around and find out what was going on, because after all, he was Japanese. And he said, of course, the Japanese in Okinawa could see him coming from a mile away because he'd born here, lived here his whole life. And, you know, he, to the Japanese, looked like any other American.
Huh. All right. Thanks for that, Mark. Appreciate it. Story? Go ahead.
Many of those guys, 30,000 Japanese Americans served in Europe. 18,000 of them were casualties. 18 of them won the Congressional Medal of Honor. But the people who served in the Pacific, it was incredibly dangerous. Fellow mentioned his friend. In the end, they had to assign 18 Japanese-American soldiers were killed in friendly fire when Americans saw a Japanese face, and they finally assigned two guards, soldiers or Marines, to each of those Japanese men to try to prevent them from being killed by their own side. Their bravery was truly legendary, and there were instances where they would imitate Japanese officers and lead the Japanese to attack into ambushes, or they would crawl through the jungle and lie outside Japanese encampments to hear what their orders were for the next day, and then crawl back to the American lines to tell them what was about to happen.
Wow, that's a brave service. Let's take another call here from Jeannie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Richard Reeves, the author of Infamy.
Hello, Mr. Reeves. Thank you so much. You answered some of my questions about the Japanese that served in the U.S. military. A lot of people don't know that, so good. And I wondered, I used to travel from Interstate 5 in California to the coast near Ventura, Port Hueneme. And on the south side of that Highway 26, I always wondered if that used to be an internment camp. Would you know that?
Yeah, there was no camp in Ventura. What there were using the FBI lists, which were listed, anybody who was a kind of community leader, a teacher, a journalist, a doctor, a lawyer, in the Japanese community, were on the list that the FBI compiled. They were all arrested before sundown on December 8th, and kept in, they were sent to prisons. When the roundup of ordinary Japanese began in March of 1942, the people were first put into what were called assembly centers. The Japanese went voluntarily. They felt it was their patriotic duty. If this is what the government wanted, they were going to do it. But for 5 months, they were, and this included in Ventura, there were 17 assembly centers. They were mostly racetracks, Santa Anita, San Fran, or livestock. I think it's called Expo now in Portland. They were kept in stables for 5 months. And, of course, there were epidemics of cholera, of typhoid in that setting. While the camps were being built in 10 locations around the country, most of them the high desert west, two in the swamps of Arkansas, and they were built from plans for prisoner of war camps They were tar paper shacks, barracks they called them, but they were shacks, in areas where the temperatures ranged from 120 degrees in the summer to 30 below in the winter, and where there were constant sandstorms from the beds of ancient lakes. People would wake up under an inch of sand, which blew right through the cracks in the tar paper. It was, Ventura was only an assembly center, not an internment camp.
Good question there, Jeannie. But the major issue was to get them away from the West Coast, and that's why they all moved to the interior of the country, correct?
When it was over?
No, when they were actually setting up the camps themselves, the point of the camps was to get them away from the coast, right?
Yes. The war zone, legally the way it was done, and these laws still exist, we could do this again tomorrow, was the military declared a war zone. The president gave them the power to remove anyone potentially dangerous from those war zones, but the only people they removed were the Japanese Americans in California. The camps then were all east of the Sierras,
okay,
east of the Cascades.
All right, back with Richard Reeves to talk more about infamy in a minute five here on the Jefferson Exchange. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is Richard Reeves, the well-known, long-working journalist. His latest book is called Infamy, The Shocking Story of the Japanese-American Internment in World War II, a new perspective on that period in American history when we took the Japanese-Americans and put them in essentially concentration camps away from the West Coast, away from the war zone, as we were just talking about it. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the issue and its treatment in the book, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Richard, we were talking about some of the people who were surprisingly involved. As FDR called them concentration camps. You give a fair number of incidents in the book that indicate the essentially racist tone of FDR's own private discussions in the White House about this. And then you mentioned Earl Warren, who was Attorney General of California, later governor, who supported the internment and later regretted it, apparently. But you also mentioned Edward R. Murrow in passing.
Right.
And then there's also a picture here, a Dr. Seuss drawing that just surprises you, that he also kind of piled on.
Yeah.
What was it that Murrow did? Would he just sort of follow along with Walter Lippmann when he advocated?
Murrow was from Washington State, and he gave speeches across the state saying that the Japanese were going to attack. Franklin Roosevelt knew the Japanese did not have the capacity to attack the mainland, but that was never revealed to the American people until much, much later. Edward R. Murrow traveled the state of Washington talking at the universities, saying that when the Japanese came to kill us, which they surely would, if you look up, you'll see that they'll be wearing University of Washington and Washington State sweatshirts, that they are our enemy and they are here. It was that kind of hysteria that led to vigilante actions. You know, a lot of people were shot, things burned. Warren himself was the creator, did many things that were. First, he rode the back of the Japanese to the governorship, Japanese Americans. Second, he came up with the theory that because there had never been any sabotage by Japanese Americans, that they were holding back and waiting for for one big order from Tokyo to begin wreaking havoc in the United States. The Dr. Seuss cartoon, he was a cartoonist then for PM in New York, was of thousands or whatever of buck-toothed, eyeglassed Chinese coming down the West Coast, collecting dynamite and then looking out with telescopes to, as his caption said, to wait for the signal for Tokyo. But intellectually, that was put up first by Warren, who also convinced Walter Lippmann who was then the most prominent political commentator in the country, Lippman wrote two columns in February of 1942 in the Washington Post, the New York Herald Tribune, 300 other newspapers, saying that these people had to be locked up. And once that had happened, Roosevelt had the cover to sign Executive Order 9066, which he did 2 days later. In later years, Lippman, like many of the people involved, would say everything they did was just to protect the Japanese Americans. When they got to the camps and saw which way the guns were pointed, which way the searchlights worked, they realized that they were the prisoners. They were not being protected. And they lived 4 miserable years in miserable places where no one had ever lived before or ever lived again.
We have a couple calls here. Jim in Grants Pass, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about infamy, Japanese internment in World War II with Richard Reeves.
Yes, good morning. Very quickly, I'd like to bring up something we have talked about several times before, that book by Lauren Kessler, Stubborn Twig, about the orchardists in the Hood River, Oregon area, and how literally 3 generations that were well-loved, property-owning people that the community depended on for their skills in orchard work and everything were rounded up and sent, you know, to northeastern California, and how their land was just mysteriously, you know, disappeared from their ownership. And the thing that has always intrigued me was the fact that Oregon history classes from mid-50s, when I was in junior high school on, teachers were discouraged from talking about this.
All right. Thanks for that,
Jim. Hood River, for anyone who's not been there, is one of the most spectacular places on the planet. It's bordered by the Columbia River Gorge on one side, Mount Hood on the other. It was a famous agricultural area, population of a couple thousand, cherry orchards, and most particularly Hood River apples, which were famous everywhere in the country. When the war started, you couldn't pick a better example of how people lose their bearings. When the war started, this is the week of December 7th, and this is in the Oak Grove High School. Students, as an editorial, published a poem. To those of Hood River, if you please, they are our friends, these Japanese, not Japs or even Japanese. They are Americans, our schoolmates, these. That's 1942, the beginning of 1941, after Pearl Harbor. When the war was ending, the Japanese lost their land, they lost their farms, they lost their homes, unless they happened to be very friendly with their neighbors. 271 Japanese Americans lived in Hood River. When they were taken away and their bank accounts were frozen, so they couldn't pay mortgage, they couldn't pay taxes, and their land was then reclaimed by the state and allocated to white farmers. And then when the war ended, before the war ended, the American Legion post in Hood River, in the middle of the night, there were 18 young men serving at that time, and like every town in the country, they had boards on the courthouse. The American Legion post went out and painted black over the Japanese names on the courthouse. And then when it came time to come back, they posted on trees and in the newspapers, statement to returning Japanese. Under the War Department's recent ruling, you will soon be permitted to return to this county. Now in caps, for your own best interests, we urge you not to return. Finally, it took the Army to get those people back to land that was once theirs. And Hood River, this beautiful place, became the kind of signal of a kind of racist savagery that swept the West Coast.
And directly to Jim's point, yes, Lauren Kessler wrote The Stubborn Twig about Masao Yasui and his son Minoru, who are mentioned
right.
at length in your book as well.
Yeah.
Gene and Dunsmuir, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Richard Reeves. We're talking about infamy.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Richard, I wondered if you were familiar with a documentary called The Cats of Mirakatani, by any chance?
No.
Well, this fellow Mirakatani was an artist, born in Sacramento, raised in Hiroshima, and he came back to the United States in his early 20s and was interned in Tule Lake. And he ended up in New York on the streets, and a woman making a documentary befriended him and then decided to make a documentary about him. And the Trade Center disaster happened, 9/11 happened in the middle of it. And the film is just one of many, many miracles and things, and it's also involved him going back to Tule Lake and kind of healing to some degree in his 80s.
Right.
All the problems that he had, but he would paint
cats. Actually, in the New York Times yesterday, there was a story, huge story, about another man of that age who went back to look at the camp where he had spent the best years of his life in some ways. The artist who I write about is Isamu Noguchi, who was probably the most famous Japanese American in the country. He lived in New York, so he was not subject to being incarcerated, but he voluntarily went into the camps and for 5 months tried to persuade to teach handicrafts and art. And then when he tried to get out, the army tried to stop him, saying he was suspicious. He was a suspicious character because he had so much prominence among Japanese Americans. He had walked into the camp of his own volition, but they wouldn't let him out.
Wow. I can tell we're not going to be able to get all the phone calls in, but let's go to Lane in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Richard Reeves.
Hello. So, I haven't read this book, but it had great reviews in the Wall Street Journal. It's called Train to Crystal City, and
right.
it had to do with an internment camp that I'd never heard of that was in Texas.
Yeah, it
and
wasn't an internment camp.
It was some
Crystal
kind of
City,
an internment
Texas.
Camp. It was in the Wall Street Journal.
Mm-hmm.
I read a review in the New York Times. So,
All right, so let's find out more about it. Thanks, Lane.
Yeah. Crystal City was one of 20 or more federal prisons in which they kept aliens for a reason. I'm glad somebody brought that up. Jan Russell is the name of the woman who wrote that book. It's a good book. But part of it is that the German prisoners of war down there, along with other arrested Germans, Italians, and a few Japanese, had lived with cooking facilities, with water, with electricity, and they were across this country, German and Italian prisoners of war, had much, much more freedom than did the Japanese Americans. They were allowed to go into the towns, while Japanese could not go beyond the barbed wire. Japanese Americans, they could go to local restaurants, which would serve them. This is Crystal City, would serve the German prisoners of war, but would not serve black Americans or Japanese Americans, even if they were wearing a uniform with a Congressional Medal of Honor. Daniel Inouye, later a senator from Hawaii, was one of those. And most of those, or many of those Germans and Italians, still live in the United States because roaming around the towns, there were no American men. The men were off to war. Many of them married Americans and stayed here. So it was, and that's what that particular bit of the history was.
Well, you know, and funny you should mention it because Camp White is about 20 miles from our studio. The former site of Camp White is now White City, Oregon, and there was a German POW camp there, and there's been recent coverage of the fact that they really did have fairly free rein, the Germans did, around the Rogue Valley, while Tule Lake, which is the camp just on the edge of our listening area, nothing like that kind of freedom at all.
Tule Lake was hell.
Yeah, absolutely.
I had a story in there of a little girl, became a famous opera singer, who, when she found out her family was going to be taken to Tule Lake, packed a bathing suit. They could bring only what they could carry, two suitcases. But she wanted to make sure she had a bathing suit, and then found out there had been no water in Tule Lake for 5 million years.
No lake in Tule Lake, for sure.
Yeah, it was a lava bed by then.
Just a final thought here, Richard, before we go. You mentioned it briefly, but about the effect on families. What happened to families in the camps?
They were broken down. It was a very patriarchal society, and small things can do amazing things. Mess hall eating is what destroyed many, many Japanese-American families, because they were being fed around the clock, some of it being leftover K rations from World War I. But the kids, for the first time in their life, could run off with their friends and eat in a different barrack. And so that the family structure just collapsed under that. And that's one of the reasons that for 30 or 40 years, none of the Japanese Americans would talk about this, about what happened. They were shamed.
It's a pretty amazing story. Richard Reeves has been our guest. He's the author of Infamy, The Shocking Story of the Japanese American Internment in World War II. Richard, thank you so much.
Thank you guys so much.